This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World. We're about to speak to Kurt Schwenk, who's the Director of Media Solutions in the Media Solutions Division at NEC Solutions America, Inc. here in Burbank, California. Welcome to Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World.
Thank you very much.
We're sitting here on Alameda in Burbank with the Disney Dwarf Building visible in the distance there. We're in the heart of Hollywood, in quotation marks. How long has this NEC outpost of technology been here in Burbank?
Well, we started the division 2 years ago, this month actually. We moved into this building a year ago last August, so we've been in here about a year and a half. We chose the physical location because, as you pointed out, we can see Disney from here, we can see Universal from here, and we can see Warner Brothers from here. So we're centrally located between those three studios, as well as maybe 5 minute drive to DreamWorks, the studios that are still left over in the physical side of Hollywood, those being Paramount and Sony Pictures and Fox. Those are a little bit further away, but still we can get to any of the studios within a half an hour.
Okay, and what you brought here is all of the power of NEC technology to the business of creating a digital cinema solution. Why don't you first talk about where NEC Solutions America fits into the big NEC picture? Tell people who may be less than completely familiar with NEC what kind of a company it is, what its global operations are, and then how your division fits into that giant global corporation.
Okay, I'll do my best. Maybe it's the easiest to describe it from global down.
Right.
From a global standpoint, this year we're the 84th largest company in the world.
In revenues, employees, capitalization?
Pretty much everything. Okay. We're $47 billion in revenues last year.
Okay.
We have over 140,000 employees.
Right.
Most people in the United States don't necessarily recognize NEC as a household name.
Right.
Many people, as a matter of fact, I have a little side story. When we started this division, a friend of mine over at Fox said, "NEC, why do I know that name?" And I said, "Well, look at your computer monitor." And she went, "Of course, I look at it every day." We are mostly a business-to-business company in the United States.
Right.
However, we are moving into the consumer industry again. We exited that industry about 15 years ago, just due to the number of companies that were in it, and we specialize more in business to business. We're now extending some of our business hardware into the consumer market because of the fact that the consumer market has become more advanced, more interested in high-end technology.
This is the so-called prosumer segment.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. So,
What are some of the products that NEC makes worldwide?
We make our three largest hardware businesses on a global basis are telephone systems, servers, high availability servers, fault tolerant servers, as well as our final piece is visual display systems.
Right. What kind of products are now available outside of digital cinema as digital displays at NEC?
We do an entire line of plasma screens. We do an entire line of LCD screens, all the way from soon to be released 46-inch down to a 15-inch desktop monitor. We also do an entire range of projectors that are used in businesses all the way through to home theater environments. We've won a number of awards from home theater enthusiasts and magazines and associations, etc., for some of our LCD projectors.
Okay, so it's an obvious combination of NEC's expertise in display systems and fault-tolerant, high-availability servers to hook those up to each other and create a digital cinema solution, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay. And let's talk about that market and how it's evolving and where it is now. Could you define digital cinema?
Sure. Digital cinema is basically the playback of feature films digitally in a cinema environment.
Okay. And that necessarily requires those two parts that NEC has already established itself as a world leader in, namely the servers and the projectors.
Correct.
And what additional steps were necessary at NEC that have been coordinated through your division, presumably, to create a melding of those two technologies into a state-of-the-art digital cinema projection and serving system?
Okay. Well, if I take a half step back, because
right.
I think it'll make more sense to your listeners at
right.
this point, is NEC a few years ago reformed a number of companies in the U.S. Approximately 3.5 years ago to form NEC Solutions America. We're transitioning from a hardware-only business to a solutions platform business,
right.
where we provide a menu of services, including technical support, installation, etc., in addition to the hardware that we've traditionally done.
So that essentially sets you up as an outsourcing one-stop shop for organizations that want to perform a certain function and don't want to have to acquire the in-house expertise and the support
exactly.
staff and so on to do it. They can say, we have a need, we'll hire NEC Solutions, they'll deliver the,
correct.
The solution.
Correct.
Okay.
What then happened is that the solutions group looked at business areas that we already had expertise in,
right.
that we could do vertical markets in. There was then created a retail solutions group, a law enforcement solutions group, a medical solutions group, and the media solutions group.
Sounds like the most fun one, anyway.
We'd like to think so. We were formed, as I said, 2 years ago. We have a group of people that comes out of this industry. As an example, myself, I have been in management at Disney and Warner Brothers. I've worked at Lucasfilm and at Dolby. We have three other ex-Lucas employees here. We have someone who worked for both Warner Brothers and TiVo. We have our head of engineering and technical is actually an Academy Award nominated cinematographer.
Well, where in the NEC structure was the expertise to know how to put together that team?
Basically, the business development head for NEXAM, as we call it for short, which
right.
is NEC Solutions America,
right.
Is Yuji Ichimura. And Mr. Ichimura was, let's just say, looking for areas to have this new group specialize in. And he spent about 6 months doing the research on if this would be a good fit for NEC. He felt that it was, and he actually recruited me, and I was the first to join, and then I built the rest of the team.
Okay, good. And so how many employees now are there in this particular office or department?
Our individual group we keep small because we leverage all of NEC to help us with this.
Right.
We consist of basically an engineering and a sales marketing group and some in-house support as well as consultants. We have 7 full-time employees. We have 3 consultants. But we also mm-hmm. leverage, as an example, for the installation and services that we do. We have over 3,000 technicians in the U.S. and Canada that service the traditional NEC businesses. They already service our servers and projectors across all industries.
And they all work for NEC Solutions America?
They're either NEC Solutions America employees
right.
or subcontractors.
Okay.
But they're people that are already on our books that
right.
we use on a daily basis.
So that's the larger team that's going to be providing the support for the equipment.
Okay. Correct.
Before we start talking about the technology and the equipment, why don't we talk about the market?
Okay.
How many theater is your organization directing your products to a global market or to a North American market or to a U.S. market? Right
this
now?
Group here in Burbank concentrates on U.S., Canada, and Latin America.
Okay.
We have sister groups sitting in. One group is split between Munich and England.
Right.
So they service Europe.
Right.
And then we have a group out of Japan that services the Far East.
Is there a central research office for all R&D office for all three, for the European, North American, and Asian markets, or is that done separately, or do you share your expertise? How does that work?
The group in Japan actually physically builds the projectors. They take input from us and our customers for
right.
projector design.
Right.
One of the things I know you want to talk about shortly is one of our new projectors.
Right.
As an example, we spent the better part of an afternoon with Disney Feature Animation getting their input because they are one of the most advanced people, groups in the market of what their needs are, and right. if you can meet their needs, you right. can meet anybody's.
So in fact, one of your function is both to output the products and services and solutions to the users, but it's also to serve as a conduit for input from the industry.
Correct.
To get their most minute specifications and general needs to understand what it is the products have to deliver.
Absolutely.
And then you communicate that back to the central R&D office in Japan.
Absolutely.
Where those needs are dealt with on the technical level.
Correct. Okay. That's on the projector side.
Right.
On the server side, we actually build some of the servers in the U.S., so
right.
we have input on that,
right.
as well as we do the same thing and feed information okay. back to Japan.
Okay, now let's talk about the U.S. market. How many theaters / how many screens are there in the United States, you know, right now, would you say?
Right now there's something like 80 cinema screens in the U.S. There's only 80 for digital cinema.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I meant overall.
Overall. Okay, right. There's about, at one point we had reached 36,000 a few years ago.
Right.
But after the consolidations,
right.
some of the bankruptcies, et cetera, we're down to about 34,500.
Okay. And 80 of those, you say, are already in place as digital cinemas.
Correct.
Okay.
And then, obviously, there's also post-production
right.
installations, of which, as an example, we have 25 of our 2K projection units in post houses
okay.
today.
Is your game plan to replace or to install in all 34,000 screens in the U.S. digital cinema equipment?
We'd like to think so.
Okay.
The standing on that right now is that it will take quite a few years for this transition to be complete. The whole point of the transition, however, is that the true money savings and the true security advantages only take place when you've replaced every film projector with a digital cinema projector.
Why is that?
Because the digital cinema system allows for watermarking, tracking, date and time feedback. It also allows for blocking of signals that can actually help interrupt camcordering, things like that. It also allows, it could potentially change and create a paradigm shift in the way everybody looks at this business, in that today we're limited with the number of prints that we can send out.
Right.
Any studio, any picture, you set a budget and you make the most prints you can make within that budget range.
Right.
With digital cinema, you could, in effect, instead of sending out a large print run today is 4,000 to 6,000 prints. A small
right.
print run, or I should say an average print run, is 2,000 to 3,000 prints.
Right.
But with digital cinema, it doesn't cost you any more to send to 6,000 or 10,000 sites than it does to send to 2,000 sites by satellite.
Now that's the main cost saving aspect of moving to digital cinema from film, isn't it? The fact that you don't have to print 2,000, 3,000, 6,000 copies of a film.
Correct.
You make a master copy, you distribute it digitally, and you save that.
Correct.
The issue has been to reproduce or improve upon the quality of film projection and distribution in a digital way. What were the main challenges in making that happen?
That was something mostly driven by Texas Instruments.
Right.
They are the core technology for three projector manufacturers, including ourselves,
right.
that have the sign-off of the studios from a technical standpoint.
Right.
What happened is that there was originally what they refer to now as 1K projectors,
right.
Which was 1,000 or technically speaking, it was actually 1,300 lines of resolution.
Right.
2K projectors are 2,000 lines of resolution.
This means number of lines vertically on a screen that into which the image is essentially divided, and separate images are sent.
Correct.
And 1K, and the standard that we're going to be talking about, most of the systems now are 2K.
Correct.
And they have 2,000 lines of resolution.
Exactly.
Compared to a television set, which is getting pretty complicated.
Standard definition has 520 lines of resolution.
Okay, and high definition television?
High definition, depending on the flavor of high definition,
right.
has between 720 and 1300 lines of resolution.
So it's in the range, a 2K digital cinema projection is in the range of twice as much resolution as a high definition television.
Correct.
Okay.
And you will not as much today, but in the early days of trying to move digital cinema forward, there were arguments back and forth as to, you know, what is comparable to film.
Right.
So what 2K did, or what Texas Instruments did in the creation of 2K, is that they were doing everything digitally to replicate the film look and slightly improve upon it.
Right.
And the biggest improvement is that, as I'm sure all of your listeners know, when you go see a movie 3 weeks into a run or 6 weeks into a run, if it's something like a Star Wars where it's on screen for two and a half months or three months, the later you go see the picture, the worse condition that the print is in.
Now, this is the same situation as if people out there remember vinyl records. The same thing would happen with vinyl records, and it doesn't happen with a CD or VHS tape.
Exactly.
And DVDs. It doesn't happen because the digital image is the digital image is created by information, which remains
consistent. Exactly.
Whereas film has particles of silver halide that rub off after a while.
Correct.
And take the image with them.
Film can be scratched. Film can get dirt on it. And trust me, I grew up in the studios as a film guy, so I have nothing against film.
Right.
I think, though, that the digital allows for long-term, consistently high-quality presentation in a cinema environment.
So we have two advantages here, intrinsic to the digital platform. One, it's a lot less expensive to send out 6,000 copies, and secondly, the images remain pristine throughout a run with a digital cinema platform.
Exactly. Those would be the two primary. The secondary is, I think it will long-term help fight piracy, and also it allows you more flexibility in what sound you want to have in your presentation.
How's that?
You don't need to compress the sound.
Okay.
The files that are big are the visual files.
Right.
So technically speaking, the sound could run uncompressed.
Right.
And the Digital Cinema Initiative specifications actually allow for a growth path up to 16 channels of sound.
Right.
Currently, the standard is Dolby Digital for the cinema industry with, in effect, it's a 5.1 or 6-channel sound system. You can supplement that with Surround DX, giving you an additional surround channel. You also have, Sony had the SDDS system that was out that's still in many theaters, and that allows you for two additional screen channels. So the maximum number of channels we're talking about today would be in effect, an 8-channel with an additional surround, so that would be 9. Digital cinema can allow for up to 16, and they're not compressed.
We're getting close to the point that ears aren't going to be able to distinguish
exactly.
The technology better than ears. Okay,
exactly.
Why don't we talk about a really basic question I think a lot of people may have as to how the image is produced on the screen. With film, of course, there's a piece of, I don't know if it's acetate anymore, but there's a physical medium that has a small version of the image on it, and a light is projected through it, and the light spreads out over the screen, and then the image is projected there. In a digital cinema platform, there is no physical film. How is the image created? And then we'll take it back to how the information that's used in this process is delivered to that point, but how does the information become light, become image?
Okay, the information is captured as a digital file, just as when your listeners would do something on their own desktop or laptop where they've kept an image, they've kept digital photos. It's done in the same way, in that it doesn't really matter if a film is shot on film or shot digitally. If it's shot on film, most films are scanned in at high resolution anyway for all the special effects to be added.
And the editing.
Exactly. So most films, or a good portion of films, are posted digitally today anyway.
Right.
Those films that aren't, you can still scan into a digital system.
Well, I don't want to digress too much, but what are the trends in terms of image capture these days, in terms of film, digital assist, origination on digital? We're talking about all the advantages for digital in terms of distribution and projection and viewing. Are there similar advantages that are manifesting themselves in image capture? And when people talk about filming a project, it's kind of a term of art now because it's actually being video captured. What are the trends here in the industry about that?
It's still mostly shot on film.
Right.
To give you a perspective of the timeline, George Lucas, 3 years ago this May, shot episode 2 of the current Star Wars trilogy. He shot it completely digitally.
Right.
Completely digitally.
Meaning he used a video camera. He used video cameras.
He used,
not a film camera.
Correct. He used a Sony Panavision video-based camera system.
So we don't have to worry that Panavision's going out of business when the digital transition. They make they work with Sony to make
absolutely
a video capture equipment now.
Correct.
Okay.
That was the first film to go to shoot completely in a digital format.
Right.
At that time, they saved quite a bit of money because you don't have to process dailies. You can
right.
look at it right on the set. You can reshoot immediately. You don't have to call extras back day after day
you
if you're doing a big scene.
You can distribute the equivalent of the dailies to people globally, wherever the director or
exactly.
people are. Right.
Exactly. So there are advantages to that. You will still find many, many people not ready to move to that yet or not wanting to move to that. It does have, although it comes very close to film, it does have physically a slightly different look to it.
Right.
So from an artistic standpoint, you have some people who prefer it, some people who don't. So
this is essentially color and tone and resolution.
Correct.
That are capturable on film with its resolution and color sensitivity that hasn't yet been duplicated in the digital realm.
Correct.
Is that being worked on?
It is being worked on, but keep in mind that you could argue both ways, but different isn't necessarily bad.
Right.
And it has a different look.
Right. There was some people complained with the advent of CD music that the warmth of vinyl was lost and
correct.
It was too cold. There's presumably a similar discussion for video
exactly.
transition to digital.
It's exact. That's a perfect comparison.
Okay. All right. So getting back then to the where we were focusing. How does the digital image that's been captured either on film or through video capture get to the screen through a digital cinema process?
Okay. Basically, if you've shot in film or, again, digital, if you've shot in digital, it removes one step. If you've shot in film, you have to digitize it,
right.
which is done through a telecine process, similar to the way the studios have always done conversion to video.
Meaning the film is projected and a video capture device films the projected film?
In simple terms, yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's a.
Or is it done directly into the lens? Is it done?
It's
into
basically
the lens?
Done straight into a lens,
right.
and that's how it's captured
okay.
digitally.
Right.
The digital files are then mastered in a format that is standardized for the digital cinema arena.
Right.
The current file formats are MPEG. The long-term digital cinema initiative specifications, which that's the group that the studio set up a few years ago
right.
to actually set the standards for digital cinema,
right.
Their specifications indicate that you need to eventually move to JPEG compression and that you need to eventually be able to, if requested, handle 4K resolution files.
Right.
So, as an example, that's the way we have actually designed our server system.
Right.
Although our projectors are 2K projectors, our servers are capable of doing JPEG in a 4K format if requested by the customer.
Right. So you won't have to upgrade the servers when you upgrade the projectors.
Correct.
You're already ready to go for 4K projectors.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
All right, so there's a digital file now that's been there's a term. I interviewed Walt Ordway, who's the director of the Digital Cinema Initiative, a few weeks ago.
Right,
and he talked about a master, a digital master that's created by the studio or the producer, which is then used to create the digital cinema master. Is that
correct?
How it works? And that digital master can be used to create DVDs or.
Correct.
I suppose VHS or other formats.
Any downline format.
Cell phone distribution.
Correct.
Happening.
Correct.
And then the digital cinema master is then the data file, the video file, that's going to generate the image. Why don't we trace it from the studio to the eyes of the theater goer in one of those 80 cinema theaters?
Okay.
Disney produces a program. They do the digital master. They create the digital cinema file. What happens to it next?
Okay. Once the digital cinema master is completed,
right.
it then is handed off to a company like Technicolor or Access Digital Media, a company that actually moves it in effect, duplicates it and moves it out.
Right.
The long-term plan is that it'll go out via satellite in most cases.
Right.
The short-term plan, with only 80 sites, because to warrant the cost of satellite, you need to basically be going to around 600 sites.
Okay.
That then covers your cost
right.
by being able to amortize across 600
right.
sites.
And it gets presumably much cheaper than for 1,200, 2,000, 3,000.
That's what we were talking
right.
about
but
earlier.
The threshold there is 600 sites.
Right.
Which you're only got at 80 now.
At 80
so
now.
What means is used now to distribute?
Right now, you tend to use either a DVD stack, which
right.
is the film is actually spread out, less compressed than on home DVD,
right.
across multiple DVDs.
How many DVDs?
In today's case, it's usually between 12 and 16.
Okay.
For one feature film.
Okay, these sit in special packaging for them, or they're just stacked up one on top of each
it
other?
It is special packaging.
Right.
It's sent out to the theater,
right.
and usually a technician is sent with it to do the loading.
Okay.
The other way of doing it is that you do a swap of the hard drive,
right.
so that you actually create a hard drive duplicate at someplace like Technicolor,
right.
and then their system, they have people go out, swap out, they take out the last film that's on a hard drive,
right.
put in the new hard drive with the new film on it,
right.
and it's off and running.
Okay, in other words, a theater would have like at least two, the one that would have it, and the one would be out at the distributors being reloaded, essentially.
Correct. Correct.
Or they get the DVD and they reload it themselves. They load that onto the hard drive themselves.
Correct.
Because all of this is coming off of a hard drive.
Exactly.
When it's projected.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it is stored on a hard drive as your information on your home computer.
Right. And again, on the analogy of the transition from analog to digital, the organizations, the companies that used to make, that would get the answer print, they would get the final ready to go print from the studio and then make multiple copies of it and put it on trucks or airplanes and send it. Now they get the digital file and they duplicate that onto DVD or hard drive, as you said, and physically relocate that to the theaters.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So no one's going out of business here. People are, individual companies that have the various niches in Hollywood are transitioning themselves to digital and essentially performing the same functions in a
exactly.
digital way.
Exactly.
Okay.
Correct.
So now the digital file on the DVDs or the hard drive has arrived at the Friendly Neighborhood Multiplex. What happens to it then?
Basically, encryption keys are sent with it, or separately from
right.
it, I should say.
Okay.
And those encryption keys authorize those servers
right.
to play back that content.
Okay. What is, by definition, these encryption keys? What are they? What function do they perform?
And basically,
we'll talk about that
they're the security piece.
Right.
That is the last piece to be recommended by the Digital Cinema Initiative.
Right.
They've left it rather open so that individual studios can have a various options
right.
of which way they want to go. But the encryption key is basically the same way a bank transfers money.
Right.
It's a multi-part key
right.
that your system has to recognize and respond to be able to open the file.
Right. Now, we've left it out in the process digital file, when it was sent by hard drive or DVD to the theater, is in an encrypted form.
Correct.
If the truck is hijacked that has it, and the pirates try to look at it, they can't.
They can't.
Nor can they make copies that anyone else can.
Correct.
Okay. So that's going to protect.
It will help protect content.
Okay. But on the other hand, the theater owners are going to need to be able to decrypt it so that their audience can see it.
Correct.
What are the physical formats that these decryption codes, or pass codes, exist on?
They're basically embedded in the actual server system, so that each server
right.
will have its own ID number,
right.
its own authorization codes.
Right. And then the key sits on a smart card? Or
no, the key is actually encrypted into the content. So the content has to recognize the server, and
right.
the server has to recognize the content,
and
it has to match,
right.
or it won't play.
So in other words, each of the iterations of the data of the film of the video file, whether they exist on hard drive or DVD, have an identification number that's going to correspond only to the it's customized so that only a specific server will be entitled or allowed to play it.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
How do the theater owners, there are no smart cards involved here to?
No.
In other words, when it leaves the distribution house, it can only be played on that on a particular server, and it goes to that server, and then that server recognizes it as its long-lost content, and then it says, we're going to work together and do this, right?
It does do that, but the security portion is still being worked out.
Okay.
But the long-term plan is that it'll go out where any individual hard drive or
right.
any individual DVD set
right.
or any signal going out
right.
to the cinema through satellite
or fiber
channel
right.
that will carry the codes for every unit that's allowed to play it.
Right.
So in other words, you don't have to, obviously for satellite, the cost effectiveness is in quantity.
Right.
So you don't want to have to beam one signal to one cinema
right.
and another signal to another cinema.
Right.
You want to, in effect, broadcast to the cinemas, and
right.
those that are allowed to have it are able to pull it down.
Right.
So what it will, more or less, what it will probably take the form of is that when a file is sent out for a motion picture,
right.
it will carry with it all the keys for all of the servers that are allowed to play it.
So it can be played on any of them, but it'll only them.
But only the ones
right.
on the list.
Right. And is that by server or by projector? Is the security clearance work done at the server level or the projector level?
At this point,
the theater owners have to tell you what their projectors.
Right. At this point, it's more at the server level.
Right.
Long term, you will probably see servers and projectors becoming more and more integrated,
right.
and at some point, probably having them all in one unit.
Okay. All right, so now we've got the file down to the exhibitor, to the multiplex, and how does the exhibitor go about then unleashing this data on the screen?
It's different for different companies.
Right.
Basically, the servers that are in the field today are all, for lack of a better way of describing it and very much oversimplifying it,
right.
they're a DVR. They're a TiVo type system.
Right.
It's the content goes in, the content sits on a hard drive, and the content plays out when you hit the play button.
Right.
That's how it is today. One of the things that we are bringing to the table as NEC is that we have done customized software that will basically manage entire multiplexes. So we have two levels of servers. We have a hub server, which is a fully fault-tolerant server, meaning everything in it is mirrored.
Right.
It won't go down. If one side goes down, the other side takes over and keeps running, and also informs us that it's gone down so we can send out repair parts.
And that's down to the millisecond, or almost?
Absolutely. If you were sitting and watching something streaming off that server,
right.
you wouldn't even notice that it's
okay.
that half of it's gone down.
Right.
That's our hub or core server. We then also have screen servers sitting
right.
at each individual screen.
Master slave, in a sense.
Exactly.
Right.
So our model is a hub and spokes, like
right.
a wheel.
Right.
So it comes into the hub, it's fed out through the spokes to the edges of the wheel
right.
or the screen servers.
Right. It's duplicated, presumably. The file stays on the core server and is downloaded
yeah.
The
core server actually manages hard drives on a fiber channel.
Okay.
So the hard drives on the fiber channel is where it stores all the films.
Right.
It also duplicates them over under secure keys
right.
to the individual screen servers.
What's a fiber channel? That's FIBRE?
Correct.
Channel. This is a kind of technology. What is it and what part does it play in this?
Basically, it's fiber optics. It's running a fiber optic system through the cinema. There are advantages to that over GigE, say, which is one of the formats that some other people in this industry are looking at.
Right.
But we looked at what is the fastest way currently available to move it,
right.
the most secure and the most robust.
Right.
And the answer to all three of those was fiber channel.
Right.
What the fiber does is because it's light moving through fiber optics,
right.
it's not susceptible to power surges, power drains, electromagnetic fields, of which you have a lot, as you can imagine, in a cinema
right.
with physical things whirring around, creating
right.
magnetic fields,
right.
with air conditioning units
right.
creating pulses.
It's a perfect storm of electromagnetic interference
exactly.
if you're using electromagnetic means of transmit, but light
exactly.
is impervious to
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Right. So one of the other reasons that we chose fiber is that the speed of transfer.
Right.
Because there is a problem that a lot of people in the industry like to call the Thursday night problem.
Right.
The Thursday night problem entails you're a cinema owner,
right.
you've got 10 screens.
Right.
On Thursday, you have four new movies coming in.
Right.
you're not just adding four new movies. You're moving the four. You're taking out the two that have performed the least. They're going away.
Right.
The next two are moving down. The next four are moving down. And then the four that were in your big screen for their opening week or their opening 3 weeks are now moving to the medium size.
Right. So you need a lot of either a big spreadsheet or a lot of drafting paper to figure out
exactly
which film is going where.
Exactly. And with Gig E, it moves in, at best, about real time. So a two-hour movie would take 2 hours to move from screen to screen.
Right.
On a fiber channel, SAN, if you will, the fiber channel speeds allow you to transfer the films in 3 to 7 minutes.
A two-hour film in three to seven minutes?
Correct. So you can now see the advantage of fiber channel.
Right.
It doesn't matter how many films come in that Thursday night.
Right.
You can either have it running in the background, shuffling things, or you can actually preset a time. Say all of your films, you know, are over at midnight on Thursday night.
Right.
Now you want to shuffle everything.
Right.
So you set it at 12:05. It begins the shuffle and starts downloading the new content, moving things from screen to screen.
Right.
But you're talking being able to resort an entire multiplex in 1 to 2 hours.
Right. Now, can that resorting be done remotely? Can the exhibitor, having, and we're going to talk about it, made the transition to the digital cinema format and being compensated appropriately, now be spending most of his or her time in some resort locale where he or she is connected to their wireless laptop looking out over the pristine beach and ocean, and do the programming from their laptop wirelessly back to the cinema in Anytown, USA?
Yes, they can. Again, there's multi-levels of security put in place. It's all run over a VPN.
Right.
But yes, you can actually, you know, with the proper authorization codes, et cetera, just as you can now at home with banking, they'll be able to do it from their home or their beach or their mountain resort.
And they can check their bank account and know whether they can order another drink or not.
Exactly. Right? Okay. Exactly.
All right. So back in the theater, the file now has been shuffled to the peripheral, the individual server in the theater. Through the fiber channel, and now it's Sunday afternoon, and people are coming in to see the film. How does the image get created on the screen for them to look at from the file that's in the server in the projection booth of the individual theater?
Basically, it's the same way your computer, again, at home works. The file is unlocked by the encryption and security keys, and begins feeding content into a buffer in the projector.
A RAM chip, essentially.
Correct. Okay. And the projector, then, the way the technology works is, at least for our projectors and the two other TI licensees, the micro mirrors, there is a light source that is broken into the three RGB primary visual colors, if you will.
This whole technology is called DLP, digital light projection.
Correct.
That's what this technology
is also known. It's also known as micromirror technology.
Micromirror technology. Okay.
And you have something like 1.2 micromirrors on a given chip.
Now these are what we think of as mirrors. They're shiny surfaces that reflect light.
Yes. And each one sits on a tiny pivot. And it's either on or off, and that's what creates the color to create the image.
So in fact the chip is an array of manipulable mirrors?
Correct.
That are, how small are they?
They're microscopic. There's 1.2 million of them on a given chip.
Okay.
And a chip is maybe an inch and a half by an inch and a half.
And this is what Texas Instruments has contributed to this whole process by developing and manufacturing these micro mirror based chips.
Correct.
Now do they also have information processing capacity underneath the mirrors to tell the mirrors what to do?
Basically, the projector itself is sending the signal and the information needed to turn the mirrors on and off to create the image.
And so these millions of mirrors are being turned, are they turned away? Are they,
in effect,
opaque or turned away from the light stream?
They physically rotate, they pivot. Correct.
So they either reflect or don't reflect light.
Correct.
It's a digital binary process. They reflect the light or they don't reflect the light.
Correct.
And that process is managed by digital signal processing chips that feed those signals into this multi-mirrored chip.
Exactly. Okay. And that's one of the true advantages of DLP technology over anything else ignoring the resolution portion of it, the
right.
DLP technology is digital. It's on and off. It's
right.
digital until the light hits the screen.
Right.
So when you set it, you can forget it. It's
right.
never going to change.
Right.
And it maintains consistency.
It doesn't drift.
Correct.
Okay.
So basically now you've got the file is in the individual screen server playing out to the projector. The projector has a set of three chips
right.
in it, which represent RGB.
Right.
You have a light, you have a prism that splits the light, sends it out to the individual chips. The chips with their on off mirrors then reflect back the information needed to create the picture combine it back through the prism to create a full color image.
White light goes into a glass prism. It's
correct.
Split into three colors?
RGB, red, green, blue.
Okay, so that there's a red, a green, and a blue chip that's in charge of creating a blue, red, or green stream of light.
Correct.
According to the specifications set out in the video file, transmitted to the buffer, digitally signally processed, sent to the mirrored chip, which then creates those three separate colored images, which are then refocused through the same or another prism.
Through the same prism.
And then
back
on the way out. And then that, through more additional lenses and optics, is spread out over the screen.
Correct.
So, from the point of view of the audience, when the person looks back in that dramatic scene that sometimes appears in films or you can see yourself, when you look back at the projection booth and you see the stream of light coming to the screen, at the point it crosses into the theater, it's indistinguishable from what the legacy system that used white light projected through film to generate that multicolored image. It's the same at that point.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And recreated digitally.
Exactly.
Okay.
Again, the main differences at that point being that if you see it on day one or you see it
right.
on day 100,
right.
the quality will be the same.
Right. But it's the information processing technology with these little mirrors and then the lenses that generates a signal that is functionally equivalent to what used to be done with light going through film.
Correct.
Okay. And with all the advantages, both for distribution and viewing that we've talked about.
Correct.
Okay.
Going back a half step, though,
the
what's also going on behind the scenes, at least in the way we've designed our system, is if you're using our servers, whether it's with our projectors or any others, the hub is monitoring what the individual screen servers are doing.
Right.
The hub is also controlling there are hard drives sitting on the fiber channel network.
Right.
Those hard drives are where, keep in mind, this is going back a couple of topic points,
right.
but that's where the hub has ingested in the new content
right.
and stored it. It's stored on these hard drives on the fiber channel. Those then copy over to the screen server, again, under high security.
Right.
The screen server, from then on, runs the individual projector at that screen, or
right.
feeds it, I should say.
Right. Feeds the buffer in the...
Correct.
Right.
However, if that server were to break down,
right.
the drives sitting on the network, sitting on the fiber channel,
right.
are running in sync with them. So you will actually have the hub server will read that the screen server has gone down and will instantly start feeding content off the fiber channel hard drive.
Direct from the home office, essentially, from the core
Correct.
Server. When you say it's shadowing it, tracing it on its own, it's outputting it itself to nothing?
In effect, yes. I mean, it's driving in sync
right.
with the hard drive that's at the screen server.
Although, if you're showing the same film in three theaters, and you've got three copies of it in the three theaters, and only one copy on the hard drive in the core, and they're showing at different times, which they would be, you think, the core hard drive isn't available for three different ones, or is it?
If you want complete redundancy,
right.
and that's where it's a a choice of the cinema chain owner,
right,
how much redundancy they want built into the system.
Right.
If they want complete redundancy, you can have a drive, you basically have a fiber channel drive for
right.
every screen.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter right. whether you've got 10 of the same film or 10 different
right.
films.
They're all being shattered.
They'd all be shattered.
So it's essentially a digital understudy that's waiting in the wings, reciting all the lines, and
correct.
The actor collapses or runs off. The new actor comes right out and picks it up right where that person, or in this case, image projection sequence left off.
Absolutely.
Okay. So it sounds like we're not going to have any, we're not going to be complaining that the film goes down anymore.
Well, in our system, at the screen point, you have basically four levels of redundancy.
Right. Which are?
So that would be your screen server is your first redundancy.
Right.
Your second redundancy is the fiber channel.
Right.
Your third redundancy is the first wedge, if you will, or slice of the fault tolerant server.
Right.
And your fourth redundancy is the second slice of the fault tolerant server.
How does this fault tolerant server work, and what are faults here? What's tolerance, and how does that work?
Well, NEC, we make, as we said at the beginning of all this, one
right.
of our core businesses is servers.
Right.
We actually compete on a regular basis with IBM as to who has the fastest computer on the planet.
Right.
You know, so we're very competitive
right.
in high speed, high availability servers.
Right.
High availability means that it's a server that has some redundancies in it. It has duplicate power supplies, because power supplies across the board are one of the weak points in
right.
a lot of electronic
systems.
Kind of,
they're mechanical, not
exactly.
Different.
So power supplies are redundant in our systems.
Right.
Fans are redundant for
right.
keeping it cool. Some of those kind of things are redundant even in the high availability server.
Right.
But a high availability server can still go down if both power supplies go or both fans go.
Right.
Highly unlikely, but it's still
right.
possible. If the main drive unit were to go down, it would take it down.
Right.
However, a fault-tolerant server actually mirrors everything. It's, in effect, two servers in one.
Right.
So everything from the power supply to the hard drives to the operating system, everything is mirrored. So any single piece can go down and the whole system keeps running.
Okay. And that's the same technology that's being used in this digital cinema implementation.
Correct. The fault-tolerant server is our hub controlling everything, and the high availability is the screen server.
Okay.
And then we also have, as I touched on briefly, is we have the software that runs the whole thing. And we've taken a little different tack than anyone else in the industry. A lot of people are doing custom-built boxes for this. Again, we have the expertise in servers as a company. We have servers that are in businesses all over the globe. And what we've done is we've taken the appropriate size and speed of our server line, and we can convert them to digital cinema servers through the software deployment on those servers.
Okay.
So it allows us to take advantage of NEC making servers for thousands of businesses.
Right.
And every time a server is upgraded, we can migrate to the new server
right.
with our existing software.
So your R&D is amortized over a larger base of hardware.
Correct.
And therefore, and you can do the customization through software.
Correct.
So you have that advantage.
Which is also why we're incredibly cost competitive on our server side of the business.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the business side here. The Digital Cinema Initiative that I talked to Mr. Ordway from a few weeks ago was designed to ensure interoperability of equipment and procedures for the digital cinema industry.
Correct.
Essentially to establish plug-and-play compatibility amongst and between the different companies that make products.
Correct.
What are the advantages or disadvantages, as you see it, of mixing and matching a digital cinema system with parts from components from separate companies, or getting all of it from a single company and presumably from NEC Solutions, and why that's more appealing from your point of view?
Okay, well, the way we set up our business is that we created an end-to-end offering that is also broken down into menu parts. So what we offer is that we can offer the prefix menu, which is come to us and we'll do everything for you. We're
right.
a turnkey solution.
Right.
And again, our area of play, I should probably specify, is not the delivery piece.
Right.
Our area, in effect, we're the catcher. We're the system sitting in the cinema that takes in the content and
right.
plays back the content.
Right.
That's the area we play in.
Right.
So we have the servers and the projectors and the service technicians
right.
and the support systems and the 24/7 support call-in center that can handle
right.
that side of the business.
So your customers aren't the studios. Your customers are the chains of exhibitors in the country.
Our primary customers are the cinema chains, but
right.
keep in mind that unless you get studio sign-off on
right.
your equipment, you don't get content.
Absolutely. But the people who are going to buy, lease, or otherwise acquire, which we're going to talk about,
right.
your equipment are going to be the exhibitors, as well as you mentioned off mic previously, post-production houses
correct.
That want to be able to use your technology as well.
Correct, exactly.
Okay.
So what we've done is we've created this in effect line of business that you can pick and choose from.
Right.
We feel strongly that one of the advantages of letting us be a turnkey provider, if you're the customer, is that there's no, okay, that wasn't a server problem, it was a projector problem.
Right.
Or no, that's
finger pointing
exactly.
as is endemic in computers from the beginning. It's not the mouse
correct.
Maker, it's the monitor, it's the keyboard,
exactly.
it's the CPU. Right.
And we actually provide everything from the point the film content, or I should now say, feature content
right.
enters the cinema
right.
to on-screen. We provide all of that.
Right. So you're essentially a single point of blame if
exactly.
necessary.
If something goes down,
right.
which is highly unlikely,
right.
but if something were to go down,
right.
we're one-stop shopping for the help
right.
as well.
Okay.
So I think there's very distinct advantages to that.
Okay.
But also, we as a company recognize that we want interoperability with other companies
right.
because you are going to find customers out there that have an absolute love for a competitive projector
right.
or an absolute love of a competitive server
right.
but they don't necessarily favor anything else, you know, besides one piece
right.
So you may have a customer who wants to use, you know, a third party server but loves our projectors
right.
or really likes our servers
right.
but has an absolute love for a competitive projector
right.
In those cases you still want to be able to serve that client's needs
right. Now will it be really easy to hook those up with competitive companies' projectors to your servers and vice versa? Is that insured by DCI? Is that going to happen?
Absolutely.
And then who provides the support? And could you end up with finger pointing that way if you got to?
You could still end
suppliers.
Up with finger pointing, but you could also, you know, we as a company are certainly not opposed because we do have the largest group of personnel available for technical support.
Right.
We're even willing to extend that technical support to other companies that compete with us in the area. Obviously, if we do it, say, for another projector company,
right.
they would have to agree to it,
right.
allow us access to the projectors.
And train your people on their projector.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
Keep in mind, though, that the projectors, because the core technology in all three, including the NEC,
right.
is the DLP technology,
right.
it's kind of like a mechanic who specializes in a Mercedes can still work on a BMW.
Right.
They may not know all the nuances, but
right.
they can still get it up and running.
Okay.
It's very similar with the projectors. They're you know, the core technology in all three are the same.
Okay. We've kind of eased into this, and I don't want you to advertise your competitors too much here, but could you talk a little about the competitive landscape and what NEC's direction or focus is going to be, and if you're willing to, you know, mention who your competitors are and how you, what anything you want to say about NEC's
sure.
advantages in that
sure.
area?
Our competitors on the projector side, there's actually now a fourth. Traditionally, there's been three. The three are all three OEMs for TI's dark chip. Building the projector around TI's engine, if you will.
Right. This dark chip, by the way, is another term for these multi-mirror.
Correct. Many of your listeners will probably know that there are DLP TVs available
right.
on the market today. It uses the same core technology, but the dark chip or the cinema grade chip that's actually two different levels. There's a dark chip, which is the higher end chip from TI, and then there's the highest end chip, which is a dark chip cinema grade chip. The dark chip uses darker metal to create the mirror surface, giving additional contrast. The digital cinema version of the chip actually has the software that replicates film color spacing.
Okay.
So that's, there's multiple levels, but the best chip you can get is what goes into the digital cinema projector.
But you can get DLP chips for home theaters.
Correct. Actually, if some of your listeners have been out and not really read the displays when they've gone into, you know, a Circuit City Best Buy type of situation,
right,
or any electronics company, if they haven't stopped to actually read it, they can recognize DLP TVs by the fact that they're very lightweight. They're also, they look like a smaller depth version of the old LCD rear projected TVs,
right,
from a physical case standpoint.
Right.
When you see the image, there is no comparison. It's
right.
It's a pristine, beautiful image.
It's pretty much the best home theater image you can get now?
It's one of three. I mean, you can...
Digress a little. What are the other two?
There's the DLP TVs,
right,
there's plasma screens,
right,
and there's LCD screens.
Right.
So the two flat panels are plasma and LCD,
right,
and DLPs can actually create a bigger screen,
right,
for a more cost-effective price,
right,
but it does still have depth to it. It's not 3 inches deep like,
right,
a plasma. It's more in the 14, 17, 20 inches deep, depending on the model.
So you can't hang it on the wall.
No, it's a floor right, mount, or
okay,
a floor sitting
system. I don't
want
to digress too much, but I am curious about it. How do those three compare? What if... what do you have at home, or if you had an infinite budget for your home theater, which ones would you get?
I have right now a 50-inch NEC,
right,
plasma TV.
Right.
The LCDs are actually excellent, but they're more expensive and smaller.
Right.
But you will see those prices coming down and the screens getting bigger.
Right.
My personal favorite is probably the LCD, just because of the robustness. I like that it hangs on a wall. It's heavier, physically heavier than the DLP, but it's physically lighter by considerable over a plasma screen.
Right.
To me, the LCD screen has the best of all worlds. However, it's purely a point of taste. All three are excellent. You know, my dream is to have a small projector in my home,
right,
as opposed to any TV.
Right.
But
you mean a DLP projector.
Or a very good high-end LCD projector.
Okay.
And again, we do both of those as,
right,
well.
Now, we talked about some of the advantages of digital cinema, but what about In the early 50s, when television first came out, theaters lost, and there was an antitrust decision in the late 40s. Television came in the early 50s. People started Samuel Goldwyn said, when people are staying away, there's no stopping them, and that led to CinemaScope and widescreen biblical epics and a whole lot of stuff, because they had to bring people back into the theater. What we've just been talking about here, about these home theaters that are creating pretty good environments for viewing film. To what extent is the move to digital cinema in theaters a reaction to the trend of people being able to stay home and get pretty good quality images and sound in their home theaters?
It's a slight reaction to that.
Right.
I will probably get this quote wrong.
Right.
I can't speak.
Right.
Wrong.
Right.
But I will apologize in advance if I do. I believe it was Roger Ebert who,
right,
one time said that going to a theater is almost like a tribal thing.
Right.
It's like a race memory for us.
Right.
You know, in
the cave.
In the cave,
right,
people sat around the fire, the flickering light,
right,
and listened to stories.
And there is a bigger audience,
exactly,
that you're with.
And cinema is the same thing.
Okay.
We're all in the dark cave, listening,
right,
you know, watching,
okay,
the flickering light.
Right.
So there, I think there's psychological things that people are never going to want to get rid of them.
Okay.
And, you know, from a technical standpoint, people can argue that theaters will go away any day now.
Right.
But as you said, they said that when TV came out.
Right.
They said that when videos started to be rented.
Right.
They've all been supplemental income streams.
Right.
I don't think cinema will ever be replaced. And also, some of the things that people are looking at again now that digital cinema allows access to,
right,
is there was a very interesting demonstration that Texas Instruments themselves put on at Show West, which was the use of a single DLP projector,
right,
single one of the Texas Instruments engines and one of the projectors, that they were able to send out a polarized signal that gave full 3D imaging.
And without the funny glasses?
You did have to have the funny glasses, but they're polarized glasses.
Right.
So they showed approximately a half an hour of content spread between George Lucas, some of his Star Wars films, and actually I should point out the directors themselves were there. So George Lucas was there, James Cameron was there with footage from some of his undersea IMAX pieces.
Right.
We also had Robert Rodriguez was there showing Spy Kids 3D footage, and Mr. Jackson was there showing Lord of the Rings footage. He was actually he was actually in 3D on screen, as he was not available to be there at the
time. Speaking of that, there are two other things I want to do, but let's focus for a second on several minutes on the NEC product line here and which projectors are available now. And which projectors are just available and so on, what the migration path is. You mentioned there are 80 theaters in the U.S. that do digital cinema. You want to say how many of them are NEC powered?
Actually, we took a different stand than our two competitors, which I should say I didn't finish saying.
No, you didn't.
We actually have, we compete on the digital cinema projector side with Barco and Christie.
How do you spell those two names?
Barco is B-A-R-C-O.
Okay.
They're based in Belgium.
Right.
Christie is C-H-R-I-S-T-I-E.
Right.
And they are based here in Southern California.
Right. And you mentioned a fourth.
The fourth is actually Sony in the process of building their 4K projector.
Okay.
And again, we as a company feel quite strongly about 2K. There's technical advantages to DLP.
Right.
So with Sony coming into the field, you may see some people migrating to that. You may see other people sticking with the DLP technology.
Sony uses a non-DLP technology?
Correct. They use, in effect, it's a digital LCD technology.
Oh, okay. And they're coming into the market at 4K and not bothering with 2K?
Correct.
Okay. And but the other, you and the other two competitors who are out there already have 2K.
Correct.
But you're presumably working on and will eventually be releasing 4K versions, or are you? Or you're going to stay with 2K? What do you think?
Realistically, I think if the market decides to move to 4K, we would, of course, follow that market.
But you're figuring 2K is going to be good enough for a while.
Well, we feel quite strongly that part of what Texas Instruments brought to the table when they developed this chip is that they do have the software that matches film color.
Right.
They do have, you know, it is a digital end-to-end system. It's not susceptible to heat fluctuations, etc. So with the DLP technology, you set it once and you leave it.
Right.
Also, the way they developed the technology is they were looking to replicate film.
Right.
4K is a different look than film.
Right.
So whereas what Texas Instruments did was a technical discussion. It was a technical evolution. Looking at 4K, what we're looking at is not just technical, but an artistic discussion as well, because it does look different.
Okay.
So whether that takes off or not, you know, we don't know.
All right. But so at the present, with the 80 theaters, they're all 2K.
They're all 2K.
How many of them are NEC?
We don't have any in a theater at the moment because we looked at it different than Christie and Barco.
Right. All the ones there are Christie and Barco projectors now.
Correct.
Okay.
And Christie and Barco looked at it, and neither way is right and neither way is wrong.
Right.
The companies just looked at it differently.
Right.
Christie and Barco looked at it as in needing to have a large projector first.
Right.
Because as we transition to digital cinema, due to the expense and the technology involved, you're going to want those transitions to take place on your large screens first.
Right, because they have most people watch it.
Correct. And, you know, you open a Star Wars Episode 3, it opens on the big screen.
Right.
So there's obvious reasons for having it in the big screen first.
Okay.
NEC took the tact And I should probably point out at this point that many of your listeners may not have realized that NEC was one of the manufacturers, because for the last few years we've been distributing under a partnership with a company called Digital Projection.
Right.
So, but as of October, we have taken that business on directly.
Okay.
So it's now, even though NEC was making most of those projectors, it's now been rebranded as NEC.
Right.
NEC, with the input of then Digital Projection, decided that because the industry would need to have post houses with projectors in them in order to deliver digital cinema to theaters, they took the opposite path, which was to create the smallest projector, the
right.
lightest projector, in the 2K format.
Right.
And that is the IS-8, which is one of our product line currently.
Right.
And that is good for screens up to 25 feet wide. Mm-hmm. And it's ideal for post-production houses
right.
with limited space.
Not to be confused with the Japanese car makers' strategy of starting at the bottom and working their way up.
Not to be confused with that. We do have, I think it's important to point out, we have 25 2K IS-8 units in post-production facilities here in LA today.
Okay. And what's the so that's the sort of standard unit for a post-production house, or can be used in theaters with 25-foot wide screens.
Correct.
Already.
Correct.
What's the next step up?
The next step up is the IS-15, which
right.
is also available today.
Right.
That will do, and for your listeners who might be interested in this little tidbit, it's easy to tell our projectors what they do
right.
because the numeric value at the end of the name, the
right.
IS-8, the IS-15, indicates the metric width of the screen.
Right.
So it's 8 meters or 25 feet, 15 meters, or 50 feet.
Right.
So the IS-15 will do up to a 50-foot wide screen.
Right.
And when we say that it will do up to,
right.
what that means is the specification set forth by the Digital Cinema Initiative, or
right.
DCI, is that you maintain 14-foot Lamberts on screen.
What's a Lambert, and why do you need 14 of them?
It's the measurement that the entire industry is standardized on.
Right.
Films are produced, they're shot, they're posted to be projected at 16-foot Lamberts.
Right.
What that means is that using a light meter, the brightness off the screen, the foot Lambert is the measurement of brightness.
Right.
And 16 is what everything is color balanced for, what everything is produced for, etc.
Right.
The reason that it's 14 for digital is that the 16 on film allows for clear film to be going through the gate of the projector, meaning that it's passing in front of the light path.
Right.
That clear film itself, the physical media that the pictures sit on
right.
in film, when it has no picture, still has a blocking value
right.
against the light.
It's kind of the tear weight of the film. It's what the empty container weighs.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
So when you remove that, because in digital there is no physical piece of film in front of the light source,
right.
it's the equivalent of 14-foot
Lamberts. Right, I got it.
So ideally, you want that in all cases, both film 16, digital 14. Unfortunately, if you review cinemas on a global basis, and even in the U.S. alone, you'll find some cinemas going as low as 6-foot Lamberts.
Right.
And part of the reason for that is that bulbs are very expensive.
Right.
Projection bulbs. That's one thing that digital cinema doesn't solve, because bulbs are still expensive.
Right.
So the part of the onus of this transition and making it good is going to be that the exhibitors be willing to maintain the bulb life and keep that brightness on screen.
Okay, so you've got the IS-8, the IS-15 are already ready to go. And
we also launched, Show West was last week in Las Vegas,
right.
which is the biggest cinema-based show in the world.
Right.
We launched at Show West our IS-25. The one we had there is a prototype. We're expecting to have availability of that unit probably in the September-October time frame.
Right.
And
time for the Academy Award consideration.
Exactly.
Right.
And that unit is, again, the 25 being 25 meters
right.
or 75-foot wide screens.
Okay.
So that unit will complete our product line, allowing us to fill the biggest screens at 14-foot Lamberts.
Okay. Why don't we wrap up by talking about money? and to the extent that you want to talk about the pricing of this and about the structure according to which these are going to be put into cinemas and whether the who's going to bear the burden under what conditions and so on for that.
Okay. One of the things that have come up at Show West, just prior to Show West, and has required quite a bit of follow-up now since Show West, and unfortunately because I'm under non-disclosure agreements
right.
with these companies, I can't name them by name.
Right.
But there are three companies that any of your listeners would recognize the names.
Right.
They're known within the entertainment industry. Are all proposing business plans.
Right.
They are these. We've had hundreds of business plans proposed over the last few years, but we're down to these three.
Okay. And how would you would name them and describe them?
Well, I can't name them because
Right. I mean, are they all the same?
They're all very similar.
And
it's basically a plan to fund the transition.
Right.
And that the money back from that funding comes out of virtual print fees. Back to to distribution.
What's a virtual print fee?
Meaning that instead of spending, you know, $1,000 to $1,300 on making a film print,
right.
they'll spend maybe, the studio will spend maybe $800 or $900 to deliver a digital print.
Right.
To help offset the costs of doing the deployment.
Okay, and we only have about 10 more minutes on this mini disc. So, and the whole question of exhibitor, studio, distributor, film finance is obviously worth its own disc here.
Right.
But if you could just sort of briefly talk about the way things are arranged now and how that figures into the transition and how the players' roles and financing situation may change.
Right. The basically, as you touched on briefly earlier, there was an old antitrust suit back in the 40s called the Paramount Dissent Decree,
right.
which is when the theaters were broken away from the studios
right.
to prevent monopoly.
Right.
So to this day, studios are very wary of that, as are exhibitors.
Right.
It is a very much hand-off, arm's-length kind of business in a lot of ways.
So, in fact, I'm not sure whether it was legislation or a judicial consent decree. Sounds like it was a judicial decision.
It was.
That took place in the late 40s is influencing the dissemination of this technology now in the early zeros.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
The long and short of it is they can legally the studios and exhibitors are only allowed to work together so closely.
Right.
At which point it then becomes a legal issue.
Right. In other words, the studios can't buy these and give it to the theater owners.
Correct.
They can't do that.
Correct.
Okay.
So what a lot of the discussions back and forth have been is that there's advantages to both sides.
Right.
The studios, it potentially helps piracy. It saves in distribution costs,
right.
both from making prints and physical movement of those prints, as well as destruction of those prints.
As of now, who pays for the duplication and who pays for the distribution?
That would be the studios.
Okay.
Their distribution arm pays for that.
Buena Vista.
Buena Vista, Warner Brothers Pictures Distribution, Sony Pictures Distribution, they are the ones who actually pay for, and ship out the prints to the cinemas.
Okay, and so they stand to make savings with
Correct.
Digital. Okay.
Correct.
And then essentially the films are then free on board at the theater for the exhibitors now with physical film, right? It comes in their door.
The exhibitors do pay fees. There are fees back and forth between studios
okay.
and exhibitors.
Right.
Some are negotiated on a studio-wide basis.
Right.
Others are negotiated film by film.
Right.
The exhibitors are also given access to a fund that is basically it's referred to as a house nut,
right.
which is that the individual picture going in,
right.
that picture or the studio representing that picture, will cover a certain expense considered
right.
the house nut, which is the basic operation of the
right.
house. That's usually in the few thousand dollar range.
Right. As I mentioned, this deserves its own show, obviously.
Correct.
But is there a industry-wide division of ticket sales from the exhibitors to the studios, or is that negotiated on between individual chains and studios, or individual films, or
yes to all of that?
Okay,
it's very convoluted.
Right.
It's very
all right.
You know, each one is a separate deal.
But essentially, now the cost of the duplication and distribution is borne by the studios, and whatever other arrangements may exist in terms of division of ticket sales as well as other payments and fees back and forth. the exhibitors get the films physically delivered to their place on Thursday night to do the Thursday night challenge and so on.
Correct.
Okay, so how's that going to change now? Couldn't the exhibitors just write a check and buy the stuff from NEC or a competitor and
if they wanted to, absolutely, they could.
But are they in a position to do that? Do they want to do that?
Some are. Okay. As as I'm sure all your listeners are aware, there were a lot of bankruptcies a few years ago.
Right.
So the bad side is there were bankruptcies.
Right.
The good side is debt was restructured.
Right.
Useless houses were gotten rid of.
Right.
Facilities that were just a drain on the companies.
Right.
So a lot of the exhibitors are in far better financial state now than they've ever been.
Right.
But it's still a major investment.
Right.
The long-term goal is to be able to get package prices, and I think most people in the industry would agree with this and tell you that, yes, they're for this. The long-term goal is to get a package price to convert a cinema to about $75,000.
Right.
That would include the server, that would include the installation, that would include the projector, and maybe the first year of servicing would come in at about $75,000.
For a multiplex?
For a screen.
Per screen?
Per screen.
This is the per screen cost?
Correct.
So if it's a 10, if you said 75,000, so if it's a 10 screen multiplex, that's $750,000.
Correct.
To refit the multiplex.
Correct.
Okay, and you're saying essentially not a lot of exhibitors have the $750,000 lying around to do that, so some other means has to be found.
Well, and some may have that,
right?
And some do have that,
right?
But it's also an attitude, I think, from their standpoint of, okay, what is the long term business plan? What am I going to realize from this for this kind of an investment?
Okay.
Because the reality is if the public goes to see a film that's on film,
right,
and they don't mind that it's scratched 3 weeks into it,
right,
and they pay for that,
right,
then what is the advantage to the exhibitor?
Okay. And that remains to be seen, doesn't
it? But I think as the public becomes more aware of it,
right,
and as the public learns about it and realizes that they can see it 3 weeks in,
right,
and have it look like, you know, when Cousin Irma went and saw it on opening day,
right,
and know that they see the same thing, they're going to start demanding to see things in digital cinema.
And in fact, the exhibitors would react if they noticed on the graph of their attendance that instead of it falling off in part, it's pretty hard to tell which part, because of the degraded quality of the film, if the third week is as good as the first, and they can separate out the word of mouth and the quality of the film and on the advertising budgets and everything else, but that they can determine that part of that increased later viewing is based on the fact that people realize that the digitally projected films are good indefinitely, then they'll be happier.
Correct.
Okay.
So, you know, kind of wrapping up that whole subject, you've got the studios have advantages through their cost savings, through the printing and the shipping and the destruction of prints.
Right.
The exhibitors have advantages too, though. They can, you know, many people in the industry do believe that it will increase the life of a given title, that people will continue to see it, not say, oh, I've waited too long, it's going to look horrible, therefore I'll get the video.
Right.
I think it will have a positive impact on that. You do have the capability of alternative content, which is another revenue stream.
Meaning,
you know, Super Bowl games, Tina Turner concerts, you know.
You mean live
kids
or recorded?
Both.
We haven't talked about that, but just say half a sentence or so about the ability of these systems to project live events, for example.
Exactly. You don't need the time that it would take to make, you know, you have the old movie tone news model in the 20s and 30s and 40s.
Right.
But it was always news that was a week old
because
they put together the reel, printed it, and sent it out. With this, you could have news content prior to a screening. You could have companies come in and rent the facilities and have multi-site simulcast locations.
Can you have live
absolutely
broadcast? So essentially, you've got camera, you're covering the.
If you have a satellite feed and you have a live broadcast,
you
can send it into the projector.
So if some cult or other group wants to assemble a million of its people all over the country in theaters and watch the leader rant, they could do that live.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
One of the things, though, that a lot of people who are looking at alternative content, or I should say looking to supply it, one of the things to note for your listeners is don't necessarily think that you're going to go down to your local theater on Friday night and see a concert by somebody, because there's also the contractual obligations that theater has with the distributor.
Right.
So, you know, a Warner, a Disney, a Fox are not going to say, sure, you can pull my new film off that's been open for 1 week on Friday
right.
night to put a concert on.
But, right.
They're
but,
not going to do that.
But you could do it at 3 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday.
Exactly.
If you want to have some...
There's a lot of models that okay. take advantage of theater downtime.
Okay. Right.
And there's also, you may see a shift in the way business is done in that if you have a big multiplex, they may take one cinema
right.
offline,
right.
not show feature films,
right.
and make it specifically for alternative
right.
content, which they can then use anytime they want.
Could this also mean that producers that aren't major studios could get their content into that one theater you just mentioned?
Absolutely.
Independent and producers?
Well, that's where... If we go back to one of your early questions
right.
about digital capture,
right.
a lot of independent films are shot digitally.
Right.
Not always on the big digital cameras,
right.
but you know things
right.
like imagine a Blair Witch Project
right.
shot digitally.
Right.
You can put that much more cost-effectively into these alternative content houses.
Meaning even the remote video interviews that Utopia Media is now doing from computer to computer using webcams. Could be routed to one of these digital theaters, projected live or recorded and projected later as well.
Absolutely.
All right. We're out of disk space, so we're going to wrap up. There may be some more things we want to talk about, but why don't you use your last few seconds here to talk about the future of digital cinema and NEC's place in it, and if we run out, we'll just have to say we'll have to tune in next time.
I think digital cinema is happening. It's already in the transition, and I think it will be. You'll probably see it deploying more widely within the next 6 months to a year, thanks to DCI locking their specs, as well as thanks to these people who have good business plans. And our plan is that NEC be a major player in that.
Okay, good. Thank you for that. Wrapping up with a soundbite, and I want to thank Kurt Schwenk for talking.